all other family members convicted of Manson-related murders, with the exception of one, are also still behind bars. Bruce Davis, convicted of the murders of Donald Shorty Shea and Gary Hinman, is presently at the California Men's Colony at San Luis Obispo, California. And Robert Beausoleil, also convicted of the Hinman murder, is at the California Correctional Center at Susanville, California. Only Stephen Grogan, Clem Tufts in the family, convicted of Shea's murder, has been released. Grogan was by all accounts the most unhinged and spaced out, on psychedelic drugs, of all Manson family members. Even in the family he was considered crazy. Yet the transformation behind bars for Grogan, 18 years old at the time he participated in Shea's murder, was remarkable. Bert Katz, who prosecuted Grogan and is now a retired Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, says he was favorably impressed by the change in the openly remorseful Grogan and felt he had matured into a thoughtful, sensitive young man. Sergeant William Gleason of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, a lead investigator in the Shea murder, was similarly impressed, calling the change in Grogan amazing. Grogan became very adept behind bars at painting watercolors and playing his guitar, and obtained an airplane engine mechanic's license. One of the enduring Manson family mysteries was cleared up by Grogan. It had become part of Manson family lore, possibly to frighten all members who had a mutinous thought, that Shea was decapitated by Grogan and had been cut up and buried in 9 separate places at Spawn Ranch. However, extensive digging at the ranch by law enforcement had failed to uncover Shea or any part of him. In 1977, Grogan, while at the Dual Vocational Institution at Tracy, California, asked to see Katz. Determined to prove he had not beheaded Shea and that Shea had not been cut up into 9 pieces, he drew a map for Katz, pinpointing the location of Shea's body. Subsequently, Sergeant Gleason and his partner found Shea's remains in 1 piece at the spot designated by Grogan, the bottom of a steep embankment about a quarter mile down the road from the ranch. On November 18, 1985, Grogan was released from prison and was discharged from parole on April 13, 1988. Although Manson today has far more supporters and sympathizers than ever were members of his family, I know of no group at the present time, in or out of prison, calling themselves the Manson family and trying to keep the flame alive. The nomadic band of minstrels, waifs, and latent killers he assembled around him in the late 60s is no more, and no new group has emerged to take their place. With 2 exceptions, all of his former followers have severed their umbilical cord to him, starting new lives. Only Squeaky and Sandra, Red and Blue, Manson calls them, their faces still suffused with a missionary glow, have remained irrevocably wedded to him and still fervently preach his gospel. Squeaky has served most of her life sentence at the Federal Correctional Institution at Alderson, West Virginia. She is presently at the Federal Correctional Institution at Marianna, Florida, transferred there from Alderson on March 3, 1989. Sometime back, the Associated Press reported her saying that the curtain is about to come down on all of us, and if we don't turn everything over to Charlie immediately, it's going to be too late. In a 1977 unpublished manuscript about her life with Manson, Squeaky wrote, "People said that I was Manson's main woman. But Manson's main woman is the truth. She comes before anyone or anything, and he's with her always in life or death." When Squeaky learned on December 23, 1987, that Manson had written to some friends in Ava, Missouri, that he had testicular cancer, Manson's personal medical records being confidential, the California Department of Corrections said they cannot confirm whether Manson in fact had or presently has the cancer, she escaped within hours from Alderson to come to him, but was apprehended a few days later only 2 miles away. In a letter to a friend earlier that month, she wrote, "I only live and feel alive when I think of him." Sandra Good served 10 years, 5 of which, from 1980 to 1985, she spent with Squeaky at Alderson, of her 15-year sentence. She now lives in Hanford, California, a town near Manson's prison at Corcoran. Though she does not have visiting privileges, she is content to be geographically close to Manson and has become the main spokesperson and cheerleader for him on the outside, telling whoever will listen, including national television audiences, that Manson is innocent of the Tate-LaBianca murders and would be a fantastic person for the country to follow, one who would give the children back to themselves. Good's boyfriend, George Simpson, does have visiting privileges, and reportedly is an intermediary for Manson. Good is believed to be the proud guardian of the vest Manson frequently wore during the family's heyday, embroidered by Charlie's girls through the years with the images of devils, witches, goblins, and other symbols of black magic and demonology. Also sewn into the vest is the hair of those girls who shaved their heads while conducting their round-the-clock vigil for Manson outside the Hall of Justice during his trial. As to those who were once members of Manson's flock or associated with the family, they have scattered to the four winds and are very protective of their privacy from the media. Because the Manson family has become synonymous with terror, like those in the Bible's Revelation 9, whose identifying seal on their foreheads their leader often spoke about, all of its former members, even those who, as far as we know, did not participate in any of the execrable crimes committed by the family, are marked for life. Since they know that few who are aware of their background can ever feel serene in their presence, nearly all of them keep their history a secret in their new lives. My latest information is that Linda Kasabian moved from New Hampshire and is now living under an assumed name in the Pacific Northwest with her husband and three children. A friend of Linda's when she lived in Milford, New Hampshire, told a reporter that Linda led a normal life. She drove her kids to school, participated in the PTA, that sort of thing. Barbara Hoyt, whom I was happy to help get into nursing school, is now a registered nurse in the Northwest. Barbara is divorced and living with her daughter in a townhouse she just purchased. She leads a very active life, camping, fishing, painting, and playing volleyball. Contrary to other reports, Diane Lake never became a corporate executive or vice president of a bank. She worked as a bank teller for years and describes herself today as a happily married, well-adjusted, and committed Christian living with my husband and three children in the western part of the United States. Kitty Lutzinger is divorced and raising her two children in California. Steve Grogan is not, as has been reported, working as a house painter in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles. Someone very close to him informed me that his occupation, undisclosed, takes him to various states, and he is doing exceptionally well, better than anyone could have anticipated. Mary Brunner, the first female member of the family, who was an assistant librarian at the University of California at Berkeley when she joined Manson, served 6 1/2 years for her participation in the Western Surplus store robbery in Hawthorne, California. She is presently living in the Midwest under an assumed name, is single, and is doing clerical work. Catherine Scher served 5 years for her conviction in the Hawthorne robbery. She now lives in a southwest state with her second husband and a 23-year-old son who was a senior in college. After divorcing Manson family associate Kenneth Como in 1981, she says she completely separated herself from the family. Like Diane Lake, she says she is happily married and a Christian, very active in church affairs. Scher, who was born in Paris to a Hungarian violinist father and German-Jewish refugee mother, both of whom were members of the anti-Nazi underground French resistance during the Second World War, describes her life today as so clean she hasn't gotten a traffic ticket in 10 years. And like Patricia Krenwinkle and other former family members, she is deeply concerned about the many young people today who look up to Manson and want to follow him. Because of this, she is in the process of working on a book, She Was a Gypsy Woman, with a Texas-based writer which will tell the truth to these youths about who Charles Manson really is. During the penalty phase of the Tate-LaBianca trial, Scher had testified that the motive for the murders was not helter-skelter, which I had tied firmly to Manson, but the so-called copycat motive, which had nothing to do with Manson. In a conversation with her in early April of 1994, she acknowledged to me what I had already known, that her testimony was untruthful. She said the copycat motive story, as well, of course, as her testimony that Linda Kasabian, not Manson, had been behind the murders, was a fabrication to save Manson from the gas chamber, and that she had testified to it under his explicit direction. Catherine Gillies is divorced and living on welfare with her four children near Death Valley. She is very proud of the fact that her twin teenage daughters are both honor students. No one seems to know what became of Stephanie Schramm. Nancy Pittman married Michael Monfort, a former member of the Aryan Brotherhood, a group Manson allegedly had a loose, arm's-length relationship with in the mid-70s. She served 1 year for her accessory after-the-fact conviction in the murder of Lauren Willett, a homicide Monfort pled guilty to. Pittman divorced Monfort in 1990. She is now single, employed, and living with her four children in the Pacific Northwest. Her main concern these days, she says, is to protect my children from any harm brought about by her having once belonged to the Manson family. Little Paul Watkins, the intelligent and articulate youth who provided me with the missing link for Manson's motive of Helter Skelter, died in 1990 from leukemia. Paul and his second wife, Martha, had two girls and lived in Tecopa, a small desert town at the southernmost edge of Death Valley. Paul was the founder and first president of the Death Valley Chamber of Commerce and the unofficial mayor of Tecopa. He and his wife mined rocks in the area and sold them in their Tecopa jewelry store. Paul also lectured extensively on the psychology of cults and the pernicious effects of substance abuse. His book, My Life with Charles Manson, was published in 1979. For years, Paul, who composed, sang, and played the saxophone and flute, and his close friend Brooks Poston, composition, guitar, had a rock band called the Desert Sun that played at night spots in the Death Valley area. Brooks, the self-described hayseed from Texas, is now reportedly a member of a non-violent cult in New Orleans, but I have been unable to confirm this. Dennis Rice served 5 years for the Hawthorne robbery and an additional 2 for violating a condition of his parole that he stop associating with members of the Manson family. Today he is an ordained minister and president of Free Indeed Ministries, Incorporated. He lives with his second wife in a southwest state and speaks, he says, in high schools, jails, and prisons all over America on the power of Jesus Christ to change lives. He has 6 children, all of whom, he notes proudly, are Christians serving God. Ruth Morehouse is living with her husband and 3 children in a Midwestern state. The Panamanian cowboy Juan Flynn returned to Panama, where he works on a ranch. In early 1994, Juan returned to the Death Valley area to visit old friends. In the late 70s, I received a call from Canadian law enforcement looking for Danny DiCarlo, who was born in Canada. I have been unable to find out from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Ottawa what became of this matter, because the Privacy Act in Canada prohibits the release of this information. I have no idea where DiCarlo is today. I am frequently asked what happened to the Manson children. There were 8 of them. 4 belonging to Dennis Rice by his first wife, 3 boys and a girl. 2 of Rice's boys are now pastors in churches located in the southwest state. The other boy and the girl also live in the southwest and are very involved in the activities of their local Christian church. Little is known of Sandra Good's son, Sunstone Hawk, except that he went to college on a football scholarship and was a lineman on the team. Linda Kasabian's daughter Tanya grew up with Linda in New Hampshire. She now lives in the Pacific Northwest, is married, and recently made Linda a grandmother with her first child. All I was able to learn about Susan Atkins' son, Zizozo Zadfrak, was that he was adopted, reportedly by a physician. The court records have been sealed, and Atkins herself does not know where her son is. Valentine Michael, Pooh Bear, the son of Manson and Mary Brunner, was raised by Mary's parents in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Until the third grade, he did not know who his father was and believed his mother to be his older sister. In 1993, Michael told a reporter who tracked him down that he had never visited Manson, nor do I have any desire to see him. He's just some evil person I have nothing to do with. According to Manson family researcher Bill Nelson, Michael, now 26, lives with his girlfriend and their 3-year-old son in a Rocky Mountain state where he is a salesman for a plumbing supply firm. He recently got his real estate license. Michael is deeply appreciative of the fact that his grandparents raised him, and to this day remains closer to them than to his mother. As to some of those whose lives brought them into contact with Manson and his family in a significant way, Doris Day's son, record producer Terry Melcher, at whose former home the Tate murders took place and whom Manson unsuccessfully sought to have record him and his music, is now primarily in the hotel and real estate business on the West Coast. He continues, however, to be involved in the music world. Since 1985, he has been the producer of the Beach Boys recordings. Terry and his wife have become quite active in the civic affairs of the community in which they live. Greg Jacobson, who met Manson at Dennis Wilson's home and was the one who introduced Melcher to Manson, whose philosophy on life he found intellectually stimulating, is, to quote him, half-retired and leading the good life in the charming Oceanside community of Laguna Beach, California. Greg and his wife, comic Lou Costello's daughter, divorced, and he is not remarried. He is the part owner of a Chinese restaurant in nearby Newport Beach, buys and sells antiques, and does a little music composition working with local musicians. Dennis Wilson, the drummer for the Beach Boys, at whose home on Sunset Boulevard Manson, without invitation, moved into with his family in the late spring of 1968, and who told me when I sought musical tapes he had made of Manson that he had destroyed them because the vibrations connected with them don't belong to this earth, drowned on December 27, 1983, at Marina Del Rey, California, while diving off a dock near a friend's boat. The coroner's report provided a possible explanation for the drowning. The alcohol level in Wilson's blood was 0.26%, nearly 3 times the legal limit for operating a motor vehicle in the state of California. Traces of cocaine and Valium were also found in his system. Guns N' Roses wasn't the first rock group to record a Manson song. With minor changes in the lyrics, e.g. exist was changed to resist, brother to lover, Manson's composition Cease to Exist was recorded by the Beach Boys and released on the B-side of Bluebirds Over the Mountain on December 8, 1968, under the new title Never Learn Not to Love. The single never got past number 61 on the charts, but both sides of the 45 RPM were included in 2020, the Beach Boys' last album with Capitol Records the following year. Although the Beach Boys never credited Manson as being the composer, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and Greg Jacobson each confirmed to me it was Manson's song. And in the 1986 biography of the Beach Boys, Heroes and Villains, The True Story of the Beach Boys, author Stephen Gaines acknowledges this. Mike Rubin, a New York City writer who has been tracking the rock music scene in America for years, says that in addition to Guns N' Roses, he knows of at least 5 other rock groups who have either recorded a song of Manson's or a Manson tribute song within the past decade. In early January of 1994, the industrial hard rock group Nine Inch Nails recorded their most recent album, Downward Spiral, at the former Tate residence. Trent Reznor, lead singer and songwriter for the band, says that although he called the jerry-built studio constructed for the recordings of the album Le Pig, and although there were songs in the album like Piggy and March of the Pigs, with confrontational lyrics, the word pig was printed in blood by the killers on the front door of the Tate residence, and the words death to pigs on the living room wall of the La Bianca residence, this was all a coincidence. That the realtor through whom he leased the home failed to tell him it had been the scene of the Tate murders. The Le Pig studio was also used by a hard rock group called Marilyn Manson, in which lead singer Mr. Manson recorded the vocals for its soon-to-be-released album, Portrait of an American Family. George Spawn didn't much care for the rainy Oregon weather, nor the ranch he bought there in 1971, and after a year returned to Los Angeles and moved back with his wife, from whom he had been legally separated. Spawn died in late 1974 at the age of 85. One of Spawn's daughters told me that Ruby Pearl, the one-time circus bareback rider and horse wrangler who helped Spawn run the ranch, had accompanied Spawn to Oregon. She bought a smaller ranch in Oregon after Spawn reunited with his wife and is still living there. In 1979, Ronnie Howard died in a Los Angeles hospital from injuries sustained in a beating by two unknown male assailants. Lawrence Merrick, who produced the 1970 Academy Award-nominated documentary Manson, was shot to death in 1977 at his Hollywood studio. The police concluded that both murders were unrelated to Manson or his family. After she resolved her parole problems, Virginia Graham opened up a health spa at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Hotel in Honolulu with the $12,000 she received as her share from the Polanski reward money. A survivor, Virginia today is the manager of a fine art gallery in Kailua Kona, Hawaii, and just completed a much-expanded version of her 1974 book, The Joy of Hooking, titled Look Who is Sleeping in My Bed, Madams, Mansions, Murder, and Manson. I appreciated what she said about me in her 1974 book, especially in view of Manson's familiar refrain that I railroaded him. She wrote, "I can't remember how many times we went down to the district attorney's office to go over my statement with Vincent Bugliosi. I have to say this about Bugliosi. Although I've never had much love for authority of any kind, he was absolutely fair, straight, and honest. He never once even hinted that I might alter my testimony a little bit to help the state's case. He was careful to the other extreme, in fact." Spawn Ranch was never rebuilt after it was burned to the ground by brush fires that swept the area from Newhall to the sea in September of 1970. The German company that bought the land from George Spawn never developed it into the Dude Ranch resort for German tourists they had planned. Today there are no signs that the murderous Manson family was ever there. All of the ramshackle structures on the ranch are gone, and the property, which was eventually sold to the state of California, is deserted, weed-choked land. The Tate residence went through several owners after Rudy Altobelli, the landlord at the time of the murders. The current owner tore the house down in January of 1994 because he didn't like the history of the place, and is in the process of constructing an enormous $10 million home that will tower over all other homes in the area. The La Bianca home was owned for years by a Filipino couple, the wife reportedly being a friend of Imelda Marcos. They sold it recently to their daughter and son-in-law. As for the Manson trial participants today, Irving Kenrick, Manson's lawyer, was ordered to be inactive by the California State Bar on January 29, 1990. He resigned from the bar on October 26, 1990, with charges pending. I do not know the basis for the charges, being a privileged matter, nor Kenrick's present whereabouts. Paul Fitzgerald, Patricia Krenwinkel's lawyer, practices law in Beverly Hills and is a prominent member of the criminal defense bar in the Los Angeles area. Fitzgerald, a fine trial lawyer who continues to win more than his share of cases, manages to do so without sacrificing grace and civility in the courtroom, a place inherently inhospitable to both qualities. Day Shin, Susan Atkins' lawyer, was disbarred by the California State Bar on October 16, 1992, for misappropriating a client's money. Maxwell Keith, the urbane lawyer who replaced Ronald Hughes as Leslie Van Houten's lawyer, is still in the private practice of law in Los Angeles, and this year was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Criminal Courts Bar Association. The cause of Ronald Hughes' death in the Sespe Hot Springs area of Ventura County remains a mystery to this day. In 1976, a former member of Manson's family, understandably wanting to remain anonymous, called me. Without furnishing any additional or supporting information, he stated categorically that Hughes had been murdered by the Manson family. Lieutenant Greg Husband of the Ventura County Sheriff's Office reports that since it was never determined whether Hughes' death was the result of an accident, homicide, or suicide, the Hughes case file is still open, though no investigators are presently assigned to the case. It should be remembered that there is no statute of limitations for the crime of murder. I write almost full-time, trying cases on a very selective basis. My two most recent nonfiction books, both published in 1991, are And the Sea Will Tell and Drugs in America, The Case for Victory. I'm presently writing a book on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. My read on the case? Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy and acted alone. Kurt Gentry, the co-author of this book, went on to write J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and the Secrets. Published in 1991, it is the definitive biography of Hoover, and in my opinion, and that of many others, a literary tour de force. My co-prosecutor, Aaron Stovitz, has always wanted, and I feel is still eminently qualified, to be a judge. In October of 1991, Aaron, who was retired from the DA's office, became a part-time Los Angeles Municipal Court Commissioner in San Fernando, a city in the northeast section of Los Angeles County. His sense of humor intact, Aaron says he is the Judge Wapner of the San Fernando Valley, and orders anyone who comes to his small claims court unprepared to watch two reruns of People's Court. Judge Charles Older is in retirement, having left the bench in 1987. In a three-volume work by J. Robert Nash called Blood Letters and Bad Men, a who's who of virtually every well-known criminal in American history, Jesse James is on the cover of Volume 1, Al Capone on Volume 2, and Manson on Volume 3. In the elite pantheon of heinous criminals, Manson has made his mark, and he appears to relish this fame, as steeped in infamy as it is. In the 25 years that have elapsed since the atrocities which Charles Manson ordered and masterminded occurred, mass murder, as never before, has almost become a staple in our society. Disgruntled or demented killers flip out, go into a former place of employment, fast food establishment, law firm, etc., and murder 5 to 10 people or more. Such carnage no longer shocks a desensitized public when reported on the evening news. But fortunately, as of this date, the singularity of Manson's evil and the particular brand of demonic murders he authored have not again been inflicted upon our nation. We can only hope that the ensuing years will be the same. V.B., June 1994.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders, written by Vincent Bugliosi with Kurt Gentry, narrated by Scott Brick. Executive Producer, Christina Harkar. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1974 by Kurt Gentry and Vincent Bugliosi. Afterword copyright 1994 by Vincent Bugliosi. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.